U.S. is not welcomed in Iraq, and that is showing itself, with it coming under attack so frequently. So why is the U.S. so keen in staying in Iraq? Stay tuned to the Spotlight.
Iraq's Ain al-Assad air base hosting American forces has come under a fresh rocket attack. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition in Iraq said two personnel were injured after more than a dozen missiles targeted the facility. Less than a day earlier, a U.S. base at Erbil Airport in northern Kurdistan region was targeted as well. Security sources in Erbil said armed drones were used in the attack, which prompted the suspension of flights at the airport. These incidents are nothing new. Supply convoys for the U.S.-led military coalition in Iraq have come under repeated attacks over the past months. Anti-American sentiments have been on the rise since Washington's assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes in January last year. Shortly after the killing of the two iconic anti-terror figures, the Iraqi parliament unanimously voted to end the American military presence. The legislation has fallen on deaf ears as the United States seems unwilling to leave the Arab country. On the ground, things look simple. The Iraqis do not want American troops on their soil. Why is it, then, one may ask, that the U.S. refuses to end its costly intervention there? The United States, that had invaded Iraq before, sent thousands of new troops there in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Baghdad declared victory over the terror group in 2017, but Washington has shown no sign of intending to leave the oil-rich nation. The U.S. cites the continued threat of Daesh as the reason for its long, drawn-out stay in Iraq, but what it's done over the past years put its stated purpose in question. Washington has regularly launched attacks on the positions of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, an umbrella organization which was the key in defeating Daesh. Such strikes have been strongly condemned by Iraqi political and military figures, as well as the public, who regard the U.S. military presence as the main source of tensions in the country.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Also like to welcome Edward Corrigan, international human rights lawyer, joining us from London, Ontario. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Becker, let me start with you and ask you a simple question. Why are U.S. troops in Iraq? Why does the U.S. insist to stay in Iraq?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And, you know, we have to take note that it was just several days ago last week that one of the architects of the invasion and occupation of Iraq, Donald Rumsfeld, died. Rumsfeld is a war criminal. At the time of the invasion, he was asked, how long would the U.S. troops be there? This was in April or May of 2003, and he said, well, it might be 5 days or 5 weeks or 5 months, but I guarantee you it won't be any longer than that. Well, now it's 219 months. It's more than 18 years, actually, that the U.S. has been in Iraq. And the occupation is one that is that grew out of the neocons' twisted vision of how they could remake the world, and that the invasion and occupation of Iraq would be a step toward a complete transformation of the region. You know, they even in the summer of 2003 came up with a new design for an Iraqi flag, I remember, that looked remarkably like the Israeli flag. It was blue and white and then had a little bit of yellow in it. But this whole idea, this illusion that they could change the whole world. And then once in the country, the occupation became bogged down. It became a quagmire. Despite what Rumsfeld said before Congress that I don't do quagmires, the U.S. almost lost the war and only was able to not have a complete defeat by hiring a lot of the resistance who had been fighting against them, paying them off not to shoot at the U.S. troops. But this is part of, and it remains a part of, a strategy of global domination. That is the fundamental strategy of the U.S. since World War II, and especially since the fall of the Soviet Union, that they could remake the world, and they could seize key countries and resources, and by doing so with 800 military bases around the world, sustain the domination. But you can see that it's really not working in Iraq, and that the demands grow louder for the U.S. to get out.
Exactly, and this past week has been just that, Edward Corrigan. And even the weeks before, where we're looking at attacks that have happened at Ain Al Asad Airbase twice in a week, and we're looking at the drones that hit Erbil. Really an increase in attacks, but it's been slowly but surely increasing, not just this week, but over the past year, even longer, even though it's been sporadic. What do you make of the attacks that happened this week, where you're having them to have happened consecutively?
Well, it sends a message that the attacks were coordinated, and that there was at least three attacks that were launched at the same time against American targets, I guess two in Iraq and one in Syria. So there's a level of cooperation between the groups that are opposed to the American occupation forces in Syria and also the American occupation forces in Iraq. So that sends a message, just not random sporadic resistance from, you know, individuals. It's sort of, you know, loosely organized. I'm not saying it's highly, you know, centralized, but it shows that there's a degree of coordination. And of course, the Americans are the target because they're, you know, looting oil and other resources from Syria, and they've got no permission to be there from the Syrian government. There's no Security Council resolution authorizing their presence. Same thing in Iraq. The Iraqi parliament has asked them to leave by unanimous resolution. There's no Security Council resolution. What's interesting, the American position or justification for staying there keeps evolving. It keeps changing. The troops stay, but the excuse keeps changing. Initially, it was because, you know, Iraq was involved with the attack on 9/11, and then it had weapons of mass destruction. Both of those are lies. Then it became, to fight against, you know, the Islamic State, which also has been basically been eradicated, except for the support the Americans that our allies are giving it, moving them around. And of course, the people that are actually fighting the Islamic State, General Soleimani and General al-Mahdis, you know, they were assassinated in Iraq, and this is, you know, one of the top Iraqi generals killed by the Americans in his own country. And General Soleimani was there as the main, you know, person organizing the fight against the Islamic State, and he had been there at the invitation of the Iraqi government. This was a very flagrant violation, and also, in my view, a calculation to sort of, raise tensions in the area and to have conflict, which, you know, the people pushing the buttons in Washington don't have to deal with, but of course the soldiers on the ground in the desert and sweating in the heat, they're the ones that have the consequences of it. Another thing is that when there was attack on the base, people, they fired back, but just random. They didn't have a target. They just fired at civilian population as a sort of a knee-jerk reaction. And that actually is a war crime because they were not targeting military people. They just were sending random shells into a civilian population, which did do some damage and injure some civilians. So that is a concern. It's not like they knew who was firing at them and then they retaliated in a pinpoint way. This was just general, you know, artillery shells fired at the Iraqi population, which is not going to make the Americans very, favored in that area. And of course, it just antagonizes the Iraqi people more and, you know, puts pressure. But the Americans aren't listening to any sort of, oral requests. So mm-hmm. the tension has been escalating now to attacks against the American soldiers. But as I said, this has been all evolving. You know, it's now, 18 years?
Right.
And, you know, they obviously are interested in the oil. And the other factor is I don't think any president wants to say that we lost Iraq and we got kicked out and none of them want to have to leave with their tail between their legs. I think that's also part of the reason why the Americans have stayed so long in Afghanistan. But they have a one, but they don't want to be tagged with losing Afghanistan or losing Iraq or losing Syria, even though their positions there are, you know, are totally illegal.
Well, let's get one thing out of the way if we can with you, Richard Becker, and that is the assassination that took place of the late Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and also Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas, which was a key architect for the PMU forces, which are considered part of the Iraqi military. We know that they were key and central in the fight against Daesh terrorists, of which they were able to eliminate them. So the question has come up, why would the U.S. assassinate these two figures? One camp says it's because the U.S. wants to have Daesh terrorists somewhat still there, so it could guide them, because there is this theory out there that and many believe that it's actually true, that the U.S. does, in either directly or indirectly or covertly, support the Daesh terror group, or elements of these terrorist groups are supported by the U.S. Do you think that is the case, one of the reasons why these two were eliminated, assassinated?
Well, I think that the carrying out of the assassinations, which was a truly criminal act, as the other Justice Corrigan indicated, and it brought the region really to the brink of a much wider war. And I think that the Trump administration, which when Trump and his generals having ordered this assassination, then had to pull back in what was clearly, the ANSWER coalition that I'm part of called for demonstrations, and there were 90 demonstrations on just a couple of days' notice in the U.S. and showing that there was a great deal of anti-war sentiment inside the United States, a great deal of condemnation of what the United States did around the world. But this is a part of the ongoing war against Iran that's going on. It's not an all-out military conflict now, but the sanctions, which are an act of war against that country, the recurrent assassinations that are taking place, not only these that you mentioned that in January of 2020, but many assassinations that are taking place of scientists and other figures, and the attacks on shipping, on Iranian shipping. And so we can see that this is going on, is that the U.S. is trying to, wanted to defeat, I believe, wanted to at least reduce very greatly the hold of ISIS, and particularly on a large part of Syrian and Iraqi territory, but continues to use different forces for what it sees as its advantage. I mean, this is cynical. At the same time we have the U.S. government talking about lack of democratic rights, and that's why they're doing what they do to Iran with the sanctions in Cuba and Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. But in reality, there's a very cynical power game that's going on, and different elements come into play in the U.S. strategy at different points in time and become more or less important. But that assassination, that was a part of the ongoing war against Iran.
Mm-hmm. Deborah Corrigan, that is exactly one of the reasons that the Iraqi Prime Minister and Iraqi parliamentarians and Iraqis themselves, I'm sure, but the high-ranking Iraqi officials are saying, do not use our soil to settle your score or your differences with Iran, in a message to the U.S., especially not only last week when the U.S. attacked that same position on the Syria-Iraq border, where you had three of the PMU forces actually get killed, but the previous times, especially when Donald Trump said we want to use Iraq to spy on Iran. The U.S. clearly is not wanted by Iraq. There's definitely not wanted in Syria. Which comes back to my original question here, what is so important for the U.S. when it comes to Iraq? If we want to take a look at one reasoning that's been given, is that Iraq is used as a gateway into Syria. Do you think that that is the case?
Well, I think it is partially the case, because Iraq is centrally positioned, and it's a great forward staging area if you want to put pressure or attack Syria, also to attack Iran. And it also, the Americans are concerned that the Shia in Iraq are forming close ties with Iran. So there's a joke saying who won the war in Iraq, and the answer is Iran. They want to destabilize the area. They actually have a map of Iraq broken up into different areas, a Kurdish area, a Shia area, a Sunni area, and, you know, to break the states down so that they would still have, you know, sectarian conflict, but also be much weaker and easier to control. You know, former Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said that they wanted Daesh because it was a very useful tool, a weapon. And if you look at it, the Israelis, the Americans through the CIA and other groups were supporting, you know, the Islamic State and bringing them arms and supplying them and to help them to destabilize the area. And if you look at the Islamic State, their attack almost all been against, you know, the Arabs and the Muslims in the area and tried to provoke conflict. They were targeting the Alawites and the Druze in Syria. They were targeting, you know, Shia positions and leaders. And the one thing they weren't doing, they weren't attacking Israel. There was a little bit of a problem where when Israel was taking out injured members of the Islamic State and treating them in Israel, a bunch of the Druze in Israel went and attacked them and killed them because Daesh was attacking the Druze in Syria. So that was a little interesting episode where the Israeli Druze struck out against Daesh, which is being, you know, helped by the Israelis. And because of their cousins and relatives that were in Syria that were being targeted by Daesh, because the Islamic State is sort of a Sunni fundamentalist movement, and they don't like the Shia, they don't like the Alawites, don't like the Druze, they don't even like a lot of the Sunnis who don't take their extreme view. But a lot of this is fabricated, and it's, you know, somebody's fanning the flames to provoke these sectarian conflicts in the area. And this is an age-old strategy that the British use. It goes back to the Roman times, you know, divide them up, have them fighting. And, you know, there's evidence that, you know, it was the British and the Americans that were going around causing some of these attacks. There was a celebrated incident where a couple British soldiers mm-hmm. were dressed up as Arabs and had weapons in the car and bombs, and they were stopped in Basra, arrested by the Iraqi authorities, which are aligned with the Americans. And the British sent tanks into the police chamber or the police prison to break these guys out. But why were they there? What was the purpose? Why did they have these weapons? Why were they in disguise? And why did the British just not ask them? Because this was, you know, their allies that had caught these British soldiers. And, you know, it looks as though, and the evidence, there's multiple examples that it was actually the British and the Americans and possibly right. the Israelis that were blowing these things up and trying to get conflict between the Shias and the Sunnis, which would, of course, you know, would truly ravage and destroy Iraq even more than already had been done.
Well, you know, this is what's confusing here, and it really puts a question mark as to the U.S. purposes. Richard Becker, you did say, and you have said, that the U.S. Also is really sending messages to Iran in terms of what it is doing in Iraq with the attacks. I believe the stance that the U.S. has, obviously very anti-Iran. But the U.S. has also made announcements, like in April. It announced jointly after a strategic dialogue under Joe Biden with Iraq that they will withdraw their forces eventually out of the country. Did not provide a timeline, however. They also did pull out roughly about 2,300 to 2,500 troops out of the 5,400 that they had. So you still have a contingent that remains there. And you also had just recently where the U.S. announced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and a couple other countries that included THAAD missiles, so forth and so on. And this was in the Wall Street Journal, where it also cited that because the U.S. possibly is going to reach a deal with Iran, that it no longer will need these forces in the West Asia region. So what is the U.S. stance, really? Are they going to pull out, or is just they're trying to find the right time for it?
Well, eventually the continents will come back together, too. If we talk about, you know, eventual, what does that word even mean? The U.S. considers the region to be still of great importance, but I would say in a certain way of diminishing importance from the point of view of the the U.S. global strategy. It's clear that and if you follow any of the military publications in the U.S., that they're preparing for war against China. There's a shift of forces. The pivot to Asia that started under Obama is intensifying. And the preparations for war are intensifying. So there is a desire on the part of the, I think of the U.S. I think that they will sign some kind of an agreement with Iran. We don't know what it will be, and I'm not really predicting that, but I think that they're looking in Washington and the Pentagon and the national security apparatus is looking at ways to diminish its overreach in certain areas in order to overreach in another area, in other words, in Asia and against China. But the tactics that continue to go on of this divide and conquer, last year was the 100th anniversary of the Great Arab Revolt, where there were uprisings in Syria and Lebanon, and particularly in Iraq and Egypt, in Palestine, when the people found out, the Arab people found out, and the Kurdish people too, that their territory was being redivided, and now not from the Ottoman Empire, but among the British and the French empires. And you know, at that time, and this is something to remember, is that the imams of the Sunni and Shia mosques went into each other's mosques in 1920 in Iraq and preached unity against British colonialism. So there's that tradition too, that the British and the U.S. and the French have, the colonizers have all practiced promotion of disunity at great cost to the people of the region, the people who were colonized by the and are okay. Neo-colonists of the United States today.
Thank you very much. We're going to unfortunately have to end it there. Let me thank our guest, Richard Becker, who was talking there from the Answer Coalition. Edward Corrigan, thank you very much, international human rights lawyer from London, Ontario. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Do join us next time. From Mika Vitale, the entire team, it's goodbye.
There are a couple of scholars who came with the new ideas, who came with the better principles. And when they came up with those principles and better ideas, how to extract something out of the statement that we have, or what are the principles? Mirza Naini is one of those scholars.
It must be indicated that amongst the publications and works of the late Ayatollah Mirza Manat Hussein Gharavi Naini, his book Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah is very significant.
Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of them?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRibe English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have two guest speakers for my today's discussion in the program. The teacher, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the outstanding book of the late Mirza Naini, titled as Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah. I think the full title, which is in Arabic, and it was, of course, the content was written in Farsi or in Persian, is longer than this. Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah fi lazum al-mashrutiyat al-dawlat al-muntakhaba li-taqlil al-zulm ala afrad al-Ummah wa targhiyat al-mujtama. This is the full title of the work, which is long, but it is mainly known in the academic fields of studies of Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah. Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, let's talk a little bit about the title first and then get into the content and the reason why Mirza Naini wrote this book.
Yes.
What does the title mean?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin as-Sain. First of all, Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah means informing people, informing the public, and purifying the nation. Okay, I mean, very briefly.
Okay.
Of course, the Arabic title is, I mean, longer than this. However, it must be indicated that compared with modern practices of titling books in the West, which consists of an title and subtitle, in the past, or perhaps even today, some Shia religious academic councils and houses, it's current to phrase, the title of the books.
That's right.
In two ways.
Yes.
Okay. In such a way that the first phrase is followed by another one.
Okay.
Ela be le or for the purpose of and so
That's
on.
Right.
Okay. Which can be translated as in terms of a colon, which separates title and subtitles in Western titling practices. This is one point. Another point is that at that time, okay, especially from the time of the Safavid dynasty up to almost the end of the Qajar period, it was a practice among ulemas to write the titles. To phrase the titles of the books, mainly religious books, in Arabic.
That's right.
Because this is because, not because the Arabic language is regarded as a sacred language, because of the Holy Quran, and it needs a separate discussion in this regard. However, this is because a great number of important books written, in the Middle Eastern regions up to the, stretching eastward to the Indian regions, we find that a great number of important books have been written mainly, with the titles in Arabic. If I'm not mistaken, and I should like to ask dear brother, Mr. Naqvi, to correct me, my statement, that even today, I guess some of the, Urdu books may bear, Arabic titles. Especially in the fields of Islamic studies. However, the content and the main text of the books are, the book of the late Mirza Naini
That's
is
right.
in Persian.
That's right.
But the type of Persian
okay.
used at that time
uh-huh.
was a Persian commingled,
That's right.
With Arabic phrases, mainly,
okay.
Phrases from the fiqh or from, usul or, for example, Quranic studies and so on.
What was the main reason for writing this book? Why the nation, should be, as you said, informed?
Yes.
Why the nation should be informed? And why the millah, the nation or must be purified? From what? From the despotism of the time, from the imperialism and the constitutional revolution in Iran helped Mirza Naini to write this book. What was the main reason, brother?
The reason is that from a Quranic perspective, Umma means religious community, religious community of Muslims.
Okay.
And it must be said that it's in fact a borderless religious community. Religious communities as separated and restricted within political borders
That's
as
right.
we recognize today. Okay. However, at that time we find that in the time of the Qajar dynasty, there were some movements, and that movement was initiated by political cultural transactions between Persians and the Western world. Okay. Some Iranian students went to European countries, mainly France, and some of them to England, and after they got back, returned to Iran, okay, one of the, first, achievements was that, okay, they tried to picture, to portray what they noticed in the West, okay?
That's right.
And part of the, I should like to say that part of the problems that they recognized to be, at least in Persia, as well as in other Muslim lands, was because of being rather backward in terms of knowledge and technology, because
okay.
They compared the technological state and condition of Muslim lands in contrast to European countries.
That's
okay,
right.
One of the reasons was that they came to the point that so long as despotism was the ruling political philosophy in Muslim lands, mainly in Persia, there wouldn't be any escape. In order to escape from that, dead end, it was suggested to the ulama, okay, that they should do something, because in contrast to intellectuals and university graduates, okay, who have still very limited followers in Muslim lands, especially nowadays in Iran, okay, great ulama have been enjoying to have many followers, both
right.
among the public and common people, as well as
okay.
among the intellectuals. The reason was that the late Mirza Naini developed his book mainly in two frames. One of them rejection of despotism, and another one as a solution.
Yes.
He put forward that the elites of the community, the learned people of the community,
okay,
should get together and should place rules and in order to guide everything. And one of the important points, observable in his book is that, similar to the political divisions, or divisions of powers, for example, the parliament, in contrast to, for example, other aspects of other, for example, judiciary.
The legislative, the judiciary and the executive powers.
Powers, yes.
That's right.
He has sketched almost the same thing in his book,
mm-hmm,
but all of them, were phrased, by means of using, for example, terms and
mm-hmm,
idioms, terms and concepts,
yes,
taken from Islamic studies.
Islamic studies, very good,
and
very good.
In this regard, it must
mm-hmm
be said that the book of the late Mirza Naini can be regarded as a magnum opus of political philosophy as viewed from a Shi'i perspective.
A Shi'i perspective.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fakhwani, really beautifully put by you. Said Mohsen Naghvi, so for a Shia scholar to write such a book, and it seems that, on that time, most of the scholars and the ulama were concerned with fiqh, usul al-fiqh, maybe sometimes the rulings of the economics among the markets or something like that. But all of a sudden, a sheikh, an ayatollah, a faqih, is going to write such a book, which is considered with the different powers in the society, how the parliament must act, what are the characteristics of a ruler, okay? So it must be very much different, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that's true. And before I enter into what you ask, a bit clarification about the name of the book,
mm-hmm,
which is Tanbihul Ummah wa Tanzihul Millah. This Tanbih is from Imba, as brother has mentioned, Dr.
Fakhruhani.
That it is to inform. Tanbih is from Imba. Tanbihul Ummah means that informing the Ummah about the rules of Sharia.
Okay.
This book is basically titled at Tanbihul Ummah, so that the Ummah, by reading this book, will know about the basic rulings of the Sharia law or rules. You know, in the banks we have Sharia. You know, we can say like rules and the Islamic bankings and all those. So for those who are living in the West, it's very clear. Because when we talk about the Islamic banking, there is a Sharia committee and the rulings are according to the Sharia.
Okay.
So this book is about to inform about the rulings of Sharia. On the other hand, it says, وَتَنْزِيهُ الْمِلَّةِ Tanzih is from munazza, from freeing someone from something.
That's right.
تَنْزِيهُ الْأُمَّةِ means freeing the ummah, the nation from ilhad, from bringing, partners for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
For doing a shirk, for example, or becoming an atheist. These are the terms, basically, which were hidden in this book. And in this book we see.
لَتَقْلِيلَ الظُّلْمِ is also among, in the title.
These were added, لِتَقْلِيلِ الظُّلْمِ, like to minimize the ظُلْم. Now, here, ظُلْم can be as a sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we say ظَلَمْتُ نَفْسِي ظُلْمًا كَثِيرًا فَغْفِرْلِ.
Okay.
Did I do unjust to myself? This unjust is the sin that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
The ummah commits a sin. It's not only about the oppression. It's about the sin that we commit.
Okay.
So when it says that to minimize the لِتَقْلِيدِ الظُّلْمْ عَلَى أَفْرَادِ الْأُمَّةِ, this is like, we need to make their minds clear about the rulings.
That's right.
About what kind of system we have,
mm-hmm,
or the political system that we have. And after that, obviously, they will be free from the dhulm and all those things. Why I said this is what it means?
That's
because,
right,
when you look at the chapters that it has come, for example, in chapter number one, he talks about the government in the Islam.
Mm-hmm.
What is a government in the Islam? There he talks about the governorship, and he says the authority is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
And after that, he gave that wilaya, or the authority, to the imam.
That's
or
right.
The prophet, like okay. Prophet or the imam.
So this is absolutely a Shia perspective.
It is absolutely
okay.
Shia perspective.
Based on Shia perspective,
yes.
Okay.
He says, on the basis of the Quran, on the basis of Islamic teachings, we know that the authority is with the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he gives the authority to the next person, like, you know, the way we have in the Quran that Atiullah wa Atiur Rasul wa Ulil Amri Binkum.
That's right.
Or it is said like the Allah is your wali, is the close guardian or authority, wa rasulihi wal mu'minin, and the mu'minin who, you know, we have the verse who gives a God when they're in the state of the ruku, which is about Imam Ali alayhi salam. So he refers to these you know, evidences from the Quran, and he says that when we're talking about the Islam and the other religions, near the, you know, the uqala, the intellectuals, hukama, those who are wise, who knows, the intellectuals, when we refer to them, even they also talk about the, you know, they also say that the governorship of a state should be in the hands of someone who is the supreme, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's right.
And it shouldn't be according to the wills of the people. You know, for example, before we had the kings who were ruling. And the kings were ruling the countries or the states according to their own wills.
That's right.
This is not like this.
Okay.
When you become a ruler, you should be, you have no, you know, significance from the others, but you need to serve these people.
That's right.
You need to live according to the state that, or the status that people, general people have. You should not enjoy the ruling over the people. For example, we have Imam Ali alayhi salam, that in the history he had a normal life,
yes,
the way the normal people had. Whereas there were other people who were, who became the rulers, for example, and they were having their own palaces and all those things. So here he's talking in this chapter.
That's
he talks about this, that,
and also freeing them from istibdad.
Yes,
means, I mean, despotism.
Yes,
istibdad of whom? Was it the because of the British and Russian? You know,
it can be anything.
Okay.
These are the examples.
Oh,
you know, we're not talking. He's not talking about the masadiq, which is examples.
Okay.
For example, we just today, even if he mentions in the book, for example, the Britishers.
Yes.
So tomorrow, if someone else comes and he says like, okay, I'm not a Britisher, for example. I'm a French. So is it about him as well? So ulama, the scholars, when they write generally book, they bring the overall picture of the things.
That's right.
Which applies on every single person who has those characteristics. So in the time of Mirza Naini, if it was the Britishers or Americans,
yes,
or I don't know, the Germans,
yes,
later if someone else comes,
okay,
like, you know, there was the Soviet Union as well.
Okay.
So later on, if someone else comes, if he had or those kind of, you know, characteristics, it also applies on them as well.
So this ummah, can it be also translated as the religion?
No, it's ummah is nation.
Is nation.
Nation or the people.
Okay.
You know,
purifying
we have
the nation.
We have, yes, we have different, sorry, I'm just cutting you off.
Okay.
There are a couple of terminologies which is used in the Quran.
Uh-huh.
Once Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says ummah,
mm-hmm,
which is, you know, the nation.
Yes.
Once Allah says millah,
uh-huh,
which is creed.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Sharia.
Millah. Millat Ibrahim.
Oh,
the
okay,
creed,
okay, creed
of Ibrahim.
Okay, okay.
Ummat Ibrahim or Ummat Rasulullah or Ummah, it's the nation, people.
Uh-huh.
It's more general.
That's
you know.
Right.
So we need to look at the basically Quranic terminologies, because
okay,
when he's referring to in his book as ummah, for example, in even in the title of the book,
yes,
we need to see whether in the Quran this ummah is being used as, for example, you know, the way you said
the Sharia.
The Sharia.
Yes.
Yeah. We cannot translate it as Sharia. Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because Sharia and the religion, which is deen,
yes,
these are two different terminologies.
Oh, okay.
Sharia is the rulings within the deen,
mm-hmm,
which is religion.
That's right.
Whereas religion itself is a vaster or a bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
The deen near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Islam.
That's
from
right.
Adam alayhi salam till Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam.
Okay.
But for every prophet, there was different Sharia. There
That's
was
right.
different rulings within that. And it differs because of the time, because of the, you know, place or the, you know, the specific conditions in which they were living at that time.
Okay.
So Sharia keeps, like, there was a change in the Sharia from Adam alayhi salam till
right.
the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. But it was ended and completed on the day of Ghadir.
That's all right. Thank you, my Sayyid Mohsen.
You're welcome.
And Dr. Fahwani. And dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. In order to know more about our other episodes of the program, The Teacher, refer to our website and visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The world with reporters.
Among the events that fall in this period is the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the incident. The U.S. and Europe do not recognize the MKO as a terrorist entity, and hold regular meetings with the terror group, which is now based in France and Albania.
The MKO terrorists are puppets of the U.S. that have been trying to harm the Islamic Republic since its establishment. They carried out failed assassination of Ayatollah Khamenei when he was president in 1981. They have killed thousands of Iranians in different terrorist attacks, yet the U.S. and Europe delisted them as a terrorist entity and accommodate them. This shows how insincere are the Americans in their human rights slogans.
Activists here believe the U.S. has not changed its hostile behavior toward Iranians. They refer to the ongoing anti-Iran sanctions as economic terrorism that seeks to fulfill the same goals it failed to achieve in the 1980s.
The maximum pressure campaign sought to bring Iranians to their knees to finally pit them against the government. But as you see, this plot has failed, like several other conspiracies they hatched against Iran.
The victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution marked the end of decades of U.S. dominance over Iran's economy and its petroleum sector, something which is believed to be the main reason why the U.S. has made so many attempts to deal a blow to the Islamic Republic, including its support for Iraq in its 8 years of war against Iran and its unconditional support for the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, and today by unleashing the toughest sanctions that have overshadowed Iran's health sector.
This gathering is held at the former U.S. Embassy in Iran, which has now turned into a museum that showcases documents of Washington's hostile agenda against Iran. Activists here say the U.S. adopts a selective approach towards the issue of human rights, at least in Iran. But they say it's time for the world to know the truth. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency, but the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down, but the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah resistance movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Julian Assange recently turned 50 years old inside Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison in London. Despite winning his legal battle against extradition to the United States, he remains incarcerated in the UK's most notorious prison while awaiting the US government's appeal. The WikiLeaks co-founder faces 18 charges, 17 under the Espionage Act, for conspiracy to receive, obtain, and disclose classified diplomatic and military documents. But many feel that his real crime was exposing US war crimes to the world. Assange's treatment, which UN rapporteur Niels Melzer described as psychological torture, has caused outrage back in his native country of Australia, where over 600,000 people have signed a petition calling for his immediate release.
Despite the corporate media running dead on the issue, basically, and not supporting him, there has been a groundswell and there's been a lot of campaigns. There are regular rallies, and of course, but we rely on the social media and other forms of media because the corporate media has been so locked out because they have been in lockstep with all of these 8 wars in the Middle East in the last 20 years.
This also prompted Australian MPs from across the political spectrum to issue a statement via video message to US President Joe Biden to drop the espionage charges against the Australian citizen and for the British government to allow him to return home.
Citizens expect us to protect journalists and publishers, not to imprison them or their work.
So far, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has refused to back campaigners' call for his release and said Assange should not receive, quote, special treatment. Press TV spoke to Australian academic Tim Anderson and asked him what he thought of these comments by the Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, unfortunately, we have a long tradition in Australia of governments kowtowing to Washington, and particularly the Conservative ones. The Conservative ones have been huge enthusiasts for doing whatever Washington wants them to do. So, unfortunately, that's a tradition we live with, and it takes an extraordinary amount of pressure to shift them to lift their fingers and do something that Washington might not agree with. But nevertheless, the pressure is being raised here.
The pressure on Joe Biden's administration to drop the charges against Julian Assange is mounting, with not only Australian MPs demanding his release, but also Italian parliamentarians calling for the recognition of his critical refugee status. But will any of this sway the US, who seem as determined as ever to extradite the co-founder of WikiLeaks? Ahmed Kabbala, London.
Violence has escalated in Afghanistan since the official declaration in May by US President Joe Biden to withdraw remaining American troops from Afghanistan by September 11. Since then, the Taliban have intensified their attacks on hundreds of district centers across the country, many of these dramatically falling into the hands of the militant group one after another across the nation.
The situation is getting worse day by day. The Taliban have captured several districts and are expanding their hold on most of highways now under their control. Northern provinces are also the scene of a rise in Taliban attacks, but government forces are not confronting them seriously.
Despite Taliban's advance, government officials have described the fall of those districts into the hands of militants as an outcome of a tactical retreat by Afghan troops who have no much support of foreign forces on the ground now. However, the Taliban militant group seemingly doesn't care about what officials in Kabul talks about the reasons of the fall of dozens of districts. Instead, the group is still trying to bring more lands under its sway. But things seem to be not in favor of the Taliban as they expect because of prevailing public anger, as because many Afghans are against the revival of the Taliban rule over the country due to the group's dogmatic ideology, especially when it comes to social liberties. As a matter of fact, locals have formed armed fronts to resist Taliban attacks.
We support public resistance fronts against the Taliban. There is no doubt these forces have created serious obstacles on the way of Taliban and stopping them from gaining more ground. They will defeat the Taliban in close cooperation with our army and police forces if the government honestly supports them.
The move has been fruitful as public uprising forces have retaken several key districts from the Taliban, mainly in northern Tahar and southern Ghazni provinces. The back-to-back fall of districts to the Taliban has also created doubts among locals who say the retreat of Afghan forces from some key districts is unusual. The doubts have raised concerns of a strong revival of Taliban and their possible secret deals. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
During a conference held by media outlets and attended by media, political, and academic figures, Lebanon's Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah lauded the work of the press, especially in its coverage of the last round of fighting in Al-Quds battle. Said Nasrallah began by stressing that the media is a partner in all victories and needs to focus on where the confrontation lies and with whom.
We cannot liberate Palestine without breaking the U.S. hegemony in our region. This hegemony provides the Zionist regime with all required means for its survival. Only 12 days into the Al-Quds battle, the Zionist regime called for aid from the U.S. Therefore, in our discourse, we cannot exclude the U.S. role in the region.
Sayed Nasrallah highlighted the points of strength of the resistance media, which he says the rival media lacks: honesty, integrity, and the mere fact of backing a righteous cause and facing injustice makes the media of the resistance more reliable, according to the leader of the resistance. The broadcast networks at the conference agreed that there is much work to be done. Some experts at the conference believed the media should develop to the extent that it becomes makers of news and writers of the discourse.
Reviewing the literature accumulated since the world wars and the modern day conflicts, we always see a discourse in the making. Resistance media have raised the standards of news writing. Today, our media are not just the transmitters of the news.
Experts at law also spoke at the conference, suggesting that there needs to be a focus on the war crimes of the Israeli entity, while focusing on legal terminology.
The crimes that Israel commits against Palestinians, the crimes are really crimes against the humanity and all kinds of crime. Israel should really be punished for what is she pursuing and what is she committing against Palestinians and Israel. The occupation is illegal by law, by international law, and this is why on the other side it's very legal for the Palestinian to fight for their freedom, to free Palestine and to free the people of Palestine.
The meetings concluded with an emphasis on highlighting the regional equation of protecting Jerusalem al-Quds from any Israeli aggression. The conference today brings together tens of media outlets which consider themselves in alliance with the resistance forces in the region and speak on their behalf. Sayed Nasrallah has given his blessings to the men and women in this field while also calling on them to reinvent and strengthen their media discourse. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The latest Israeli airstrike over the Gaza Strip has left several families homeless. In northern parts of the enclave, tents have replaced high-rise buildings leveled by Israeli airstrike. Abu Muhammad, a father of 11 children, has his three-story building bombed. He is now living with his family in his damaged home with nowhere to go.
They bombed our house with no prior notice. We had to escape the streets, leaving all of our belongings in the house. People helped us and offered shelter in armed wire schools. When the war was over, some people went back to their homes, but I felt miserable because I had nowhere to go. We have no way but to live in the tents.
Ala, a Gazan student, has all her belongings damaged when the Israeli regime bombed their home. She is now not able to pursue her studies due to the crisis she is caught in.
We thought we were secured in our home, but they hit us. When I got back here to see what happened to the home, I found my belongings all damaged. My laptop, books, and clothes are all ruined. Now I'm not able to continue my studying. I just want to live peacefully and concentrate on making a better future, and this can never happen while Israeli regime keeps bombing us.
The Gaza Housing Ministry says 1,800 housing units have been totally destroyed and 17,000 partially damaged in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians are still recovering the 2014 war in Gaza that caused huge destruction, and the latest onslaught increased the tragedy. Umm Muhammad visits the building that housed her family for more than 10 years, crumpled down by Israeli airstrikes.
When I first saw my home destroyed, I could not stand up on my feet anymore. Nothing is left safe. We were preparing new units for our sons Mohammed and Ahmed to maintain their life, and now, after 10 years of hard work and saving to redesign this home, everything is destroyed.
The scene of displaced families have turned into a familiar scene in Gaza, as most of Gazans have lost their homes in Israeli airstrikes. Many of them are now camping on the rubble of their homes with nowhere else to go. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Hans Grundberg, known as the ambassador of the European Union to Yemen, is now the UN special envoy for the Arab country. He succeeded Martin Griffiths of the United Kingdom, who was appointed in February 2018 but failed to find a peaceful solution to the years-long war on Yemen.
The large number of UN appointments will not change anything as long as there is no will to separate the humanitarian situation from the military and political issues. Changing the UN envoy will return the political process to zero because he will bring new agenda that will certainly serve the US and the Saudi-led coalition, including obtaining new funding for the operational budget of the UN organizations.
The member of Yemen Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, says that the new UN envoy for Yemen won't bring anything new as long as the Saudi war and the blockade persist. He has called on the UN and its Security Council to stop supporting the US and Britain and start supporting permanent peace.
The recent UN resolutions have proven that the funding that the United Nations obtains from Saudi Arabia affects its decisions. If Yemen has provided funding to the UN envoy and his organization, the international body would have taken decisions in favor of the Yemenis. I believe that there will be no change in the political process, as the United Nations is not serious about committing to the principles and laws on which it was first established, which has become worthless now. All Yemenis have lost their confidence in the UN and all those who follow it.
Millions of Yemenis have been under a tight blockade since March 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen to reinstate a friendly regime there. The war has brought Yemen to what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Observers say neither Grundberg nor anybody else can put an end to the suffering of millions of Yemenis as long as the UN puts a blind eye to Saudi atrocities. That's due to the kingdom's funding for the world body. They believe that Yemeni military operations are the only way to push Riyadh toward the political solution. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
The
Sudanese government vowed to work with Ethiopian parties to enhance Ethiopia's unity amid the current conflicts in the African country. In a statement, Khartoum said it would work with the regional and international community to achieve peace in the neighboring country. Following an emergency meeting to assess the overall situation, it also urged all conflict parties to sit around the negotiation table and ensure humanitarian aid access to all those in need. The conflict in Tigray, Ethiopia, has driven over